For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
I'm very happy to have giving our talk tonight Katie Dudzik, who's our Doan and Promotions Committee person, and is one of the three people, one of the four people who's going to be leading the, who is leading the Thursday evening Suzuki Roshi discussions, along with Ben and Jeremy. So thank you very much for being willing to speak with us, Katie.
Thank you. Thank you all for being here tonight. First of all, I want to thank my teacher, Taigen. Thank you, Taigen, for this opportunity to speak tonight. And thank you to the Sangha. And hopefully I will provide you with some things to think about tonight. So I'm going to talk a little bit about myself and talk about how I came to practice. And then some, just a couple different meaningful pieces of practice that I've been kind of stewing on for the past couple of years that I would like to share with you. So, first of all, a little bit of biography. I'm from Mesa, Arizona. I grew up in Elk Grove Village, Illinois, and I always like to tell this childhood story. When I was about 4 years old, I did not very much like when my mom would put little foam hair colors in my head before bed. I don't know why people do that. In fact, and it hurt my head. It was very, very disturbing to me. And I always complained to her, why are you doing this? Why does this have to happen? And she wouldn't listen. So one day I got some scissors and just cut them out. And the next morning she saw a bunch of hair in the trash and somehow assumed that I was ill and dying. It was a very desperate conclusion. But so that was me as a kid. And I was raised Catholic, and I went to Catholic school from three-year-old preschool to eighth grade. So the same 30 kids throughout those years. So then when I went to high school, it was a little bit of a culture shock. I had about 700 kids in my public school that I graduated with. I don't really have anything particularly exciting or positive to say about high school, so I'll probably skip over that quite quickly. I feel very thankful to have survived that. And yeah. So and in terms of my upbringing, I mentioned that I was raised Catholic, and I, so much so that the house that I grew up in and the house that my parents still live in now has a very large cross in front of it. In fact, people think it's a church, and when I was little, people would constantly make fun of me, like, what we're picking up? Where should we pick you up? And I would say, there's a big cross. It's a third house, obviously. That was always a fun thing to get made fun of for. But I'm very, very grateful for the rituals that I learned, and I feel like the rituals of the Soto Zen lineage provide a lot of solace for me because of all that I experienced for all those years. But in general, I'd say that the teachings of the Catholic Church have not been very positive for me and just bring up a lot of fear and exclusivity, and I find it really hard to relate to, so sort of distanced myself from that. But in any case, I feel like my parents raised me to be a person for others and to care deeply about the world and my community, and just to love unconditionally and to have try to establish connection with everyone and just a deep respect for all beings. And I think I've taken that with me throughout my life, and I still wonder how I can embody compassion and where am I called to take action every day and what that means for me. And I took that into college and I studied social work. And I've had a lot of opportunity to question that in different ways, and I continue to question that in different ways. And I think, you know, I just this weekend I saw the movie Selma, and I don't want to spend too much time talking about that, but I feel like it just reminds me on a daily basis of, you know, what is my privilege asking of me, and what kind of action can I take. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later. My first week at college, there's a freshman convocation, and I was very lucky to hear Thich Nhat Hanh speak. Mm-hmm. He welcomed me to college. I always say that he welcomed me to college, and the sort of a new environment of being raised in the suburbs and going to an urban environment for college, and having all these new doors open for me. And I'm very grateful for that experience, and to sort of be able to have sort of discovered different things and made new connections with people. But I would say that transition has never been my strong suit, and that will be a theme in this talk. I remember my first week of college, despite being welcomed by Thich Nhat Hanh, I was very anxious about the transition, and for the first whole week, I didn't eat a single thing. I had all this free food, and people kept bringing me food, and my parents came to visit, and they brought me all this food, and I just was so anxious and so scared of this new beginning. Very excited, but also really scared. So I didn't eat for a week, and I vomited like every single day. That's what my body does, unfortunately, when I'm really anxious, is vomit. So, sorry to anyone who is disturbed by that, but it's part of my life. So we'll talk about more transitions in a minute. After I went to college, I moved to Minneapolis for 2 years, and I did a sort of like an AmeriCorps program called the Lutheran Volunteer Corps, and it was wonderful. 2 years in Minneapolis, and I lived in intentional community with about five other people, and started many different exciting traditions that I'll talk about. And my life was just very full of structure and full of purpose, and kind of had a lot of opportunities for growth and of meeting new people. And I moved there specifically to work with the Somali community, and I got to just learn a lot about that community, and it was a really wonderful experience. And then when I moved back to Chicago, that was another really difficult transition for me. Apparently I don't do well with those, as you can tell. And I just went into probably maybe like a clinical depression. I'm not exactly sure. It doesn't really matter to me what it was, but it was not very pleasant. And I was just really having difficulty with having all this structure, and then kind of coming back to Chicago without a job, without a lot of my community from college had moved away, and it was very difficult. And I started sitting alone, but I just wasn't feeling right. I was not motivated really, and without a community, without a sangha, I just really didn't feel, you know, I just wasn't feeling it. So I started reading some books, maybe some Zen books and other Buddhist books. And then I had a really painful breakup and had a lot of free time and a lot more motivation. So I looked online and I saw, okay, this Ancient Dragon Sangha, it's pretty close by. So I biked one Sunday morning, and the rest is history. I think, Kathy, you were my Zazen instructor, so thank you for that. And it was just very helpful at that point to have the sangha. I don't think I really talked to anyone for the first like year I was here, but just to sit with other people definitely felt good to me. And looking back now, I just looked at my journal from that transition period, and it's just so interesting to see how stuck I was. Not that I don't get stuck now all the time, but really just a lot of grieving for all different things, and a lot of you know, really petty things that I wasn't noticing them, and I kind of just let them go. And it's nice to be able to kind of come and face the wall and face myself and kind of notice those things in a different way now and catch myself before I get so anxious that I vomit. So it was just a very good introduction to the Dharma and what it is to really make my best effort in each moment. In each moment. I mean, I think that was sort of kind of eye-opening for me to learn about that and to practice with that. I would like to share some teachings that have been really helpful to me and that give me a lot of joy, and it would just be very wonderful to share some of those with me and with you guys. When I lived in Minneapolis, I started a tradition. I don't know how it happened, but we found this book in our house by Parker Palmer. He's a writer, activist, theologian. He lives in Madison, Wisconsin. He wrote this book about vocation, and I don't think any of us had actually read the book, but we saw at the end there's a little section for each season and how each season is a metaphor for our lives. And since it's winter now, I might read a little bit of winter, but first I wanted to read just a really short section about the introduction that he mentions. So, seasons is a wise metaphor for the movement of life, I think. It suggests that life is neither a battlefield nor a game of chance, but something infinitely richer, more promising, more real. The notion that our lives are like the eternal cycle of the seasons does not deny the struggle or the joy, the loss or the gain, the darkness or the light, but encourages us to embrace it all and to find in all of it opportunities for growth. If we live close to nature in an agricultural society, the seasons as metaphor and fact would continually frame our lives. But the master metaphor of our era does not come from agriculture. It comes from manufacturing. We do not believe that we grow our lives. We believe that we make them. Just listen to how we use the word in everyday speech. We make time, make friends, make meaning, make money, make a living, make love. I once heard Alan Watts observe that a Chinese child will ask, "How does a baby grow?" But an American child will ask, "How do you make a baby?" From an early age, we absorb our culture's arrogant conviction that we manufacture everything, reducing the world to mere raw material that lacks all value until we impose our designs and labor on it. So I'm going to pause for a drink of water before I go on to winter. Okay, so winter. The little depths of autumn are mild precursors to the rigor mortis of winter. The southern humorist Roy Blunt has opined that in the upper Midwest, where I live, what we get in winter is not weather, but divine retribution. He believes that someone here once did something very, very bad, and we are still paying the price for that transgression. Winter here is a demanding season, and not everyone appreciates the discipline. It is a season when death's victory can seem supreme. Few creatures stir, plants do not visibly grow, and nature feels like our enemy. And yet the rigors of winter, like the diminishments of autumn, are accompanied by amazing gifts. One gift is beauty, different from the beauty of autumn, but somehow lovelier still. I'm not sure that any sight or sound on earth is as exquisite as the hushed descent of a sky full of snow. Another gift is the reminder that times of dormancy and deep rest are essential to all living things. Despite all appearances, of course, nature is not dead in winter. It has gone underground to renew itself and prepare for spring. Winter is a time when we are admonished and even inclined to do the same for ourselves. But for me, winter has an even greater gift to give. It comes when the sky is clear, the sun is brilliant, the trees are bare, and first snow is yet to come. It is a gift of utter clarity. In winter, One can walk into woods that have been opaque with summer growth only a few months earlier and see the trees clearly, singly, and together, and see the ground they are rooted in. A few years ago, my father died. He was more than a good man, and the months following his death were a long, hard winter for me. But in the midst of that ice and loss, I came into a certain clarity that I lacked when he was alive. I saw something that had been concealed with the luxuriance of his love surrounding me. Saw how I relied on him to help me cushion life's harsher blows. When he could no longer do that, my first thought was, now I must do it for myself. But as time went on, I saw a deeper truth. It never was my father absorbing those blows, but a larger and deeper grace that he taught me to rely on. When my father was alive, I confused the teaching with the teacher. My teacher is gone now, but the grace is still there, and my clarity about that fact has allowed his teaching to take deeper root in me. Winter clears the landscape, however brutally, giving us a chance to see ourselves and each other more clearly, to see the very ground of our being. And if anyone's fallen asleep, this is time to wake up. In the upper Midwest, newcomers often receive a classic piece of wintertime advice. The winters will drive you crazy until you learn to get out into them. Here, people spend good money on warm clothing so that they can get outdoors and avoid the cabin fever that comes from huddling fearfully by the fire during the hard frozen months. If you live here long, you learn that a daily walk into the winter world will fortify the spirit by taking you boldly to the very heart of the season you fear. Our inward winters take many forms: failure, betrayal, depression, death, but every one of them, in my experience, yields to the same advice. The winters will drive you crazy until you learn to get out into them. Until we enter boldly into the fears we most want to avoid, those fears will dominate our lives. When we walk directly into them, protected from frostbite by the warm garb of friendship or inner discipline or spiritual guidance, we can learn what they have to teach us. Then we discover once again that the cycle of the seasons is trustworthy and life-giving, even in the most dismaying season of all. So it took me forever to decide what part of that to read, so I just decided to read the whole thing.
That's great.
My old housemates and I, every season we call each other from Minnesota, Wisconsin, Texas, Culebra, and we read it aloud to each other, whatever the season may be, and talk about that. There's a lot in there. But I just want to kind of focus on most of the end of the reading and talk just briefly, mostly hear your comments about that. So it is indeed February 9th, and I think we've had a mild winter, but I did write this before that blizzard, so I don't know if everyone has the same feelings. And it was really slippery outside today, and I was kind of worried for people. But otherwise, it's been kind of a fun winter, and I've really enjoyed kind of getting out there and doing winter activities. And I feel like it's really hard. It's been really hard in the past for me. I'm usually just really grumpy. I don't really want to go outside, but that is, you know, one of my practices, one of my challenges, to get outside and you'll go for a walk. But it also, you know, this, what I think about when I read this most winters is, what am I scared of? Like, what are my fears right now? And they're always really different. I feel like this year, the fear that I realize and I see the most, I'm really afraid of being wrong. I don't want to be wrong. I don't like it. I'm wrong a lot. So it's really hard because I don't want to admit that I'm wrong. I especially don't want to admit that I'm wrong to other people, let alone myself. So, but I didn't have that fear last year. I still was afraid to be wrong. I just didn't recognize that I had that fear last year. So that's really a fun thing about this reading, to kind of reflect on each season of reading the same passage over and over again. But it'd be really easy for me to kind of just sit inside and sulk and sit in my chair. But instead, I really try to get outside and call my friend when I'm short-sighted and when I'm being a jerk and whatever the case may be. And the other thing that I think about is a couple different parts of the Genjo Koan. Both with this talk, you know, when I was preparing to do my talk about Way Seeking Mind and how I came to practice, I thought a lot about the parts when Dogen says, when you first seek Dharma, you imagine you are far away from its environs, but Dharma is already correctly transmitted, and you are immediately your original self. I think that's... I mean, every part of that is really helpful to my practice. And, you know, just kind of... winter is here. Be winter. We need, you know... I think... what does that mean for us? I mean, I think it probably takes different meanings for everyone. I'm curious to see if anyone has thoughts about that. But I often just try to tell myself, you know, stop waiting for spring. I feel like I've always sort of been waiting for something else, waiting for something better to come along, waiting for the next moment. But just to be present right now is just seems so simple. Yeah, it's really, really difficult. And then I really want to share one more quote, and I'll just be wrapping this up soon, so start thinking about exciting comments. So a couple years ago, I don't remember where, when, what I was doing, but I heard this quote from Suzuki Roshi's widow, Mitsuyu Suzuki Sensei, and I think, if I recall correctly, someone had asked her, like, what... you know, how do you live a long, happy life? And she said, walk every day, don't hate anyone, and have good conversations. Which is, again, just a really simple 3 points, but something that I think about every single day. Like, how can I do those 3 things? And it also helps to sort of simplify. I'm constantly trying to be better and work on being stuck on everything, and it's nice to simplify for me. Okay, there's just these 3 things. If I can just work on these 3 things today, okay, this is doable. And
can you say the 3 again?
Yo, absolutely. Walk every day. Don't hate anyone. Have good conversations. So the walking every day is something that, you know, even Parker Palmer mentioned it in his winter writings. And it is very meaningful to me to, and I think definitely part of my practice, to walk every day and sometimes to the same places, sometimes explore different places. I mean, it's definitely a good exploration tool for the city. We live in such a beautiful, I think, enormous city, and there's always new things to discover. And I get some really good thinking done when I'm walking, and it's just a good alternative sometimes too, especially... feel like constantly in a rush, I gotta get to this place, gotta get to this place, but sometimes it's just kind of hold off on having these deadlines for myself and just walk somewhere. And don't hate anyone. I gotta tell you guys, I dislike people. Some people a lot. And it's hard. They drive me nuts. And I just really, it's amazing how many insincere thoughts I have about other people. So this is something that I will be practicing with forever, definitely. And, but I also, it feels really connected with, like, my struggle to let go of things. I get really stuck with, like, the most basic things someone says to me. They'll make just really basic comment. Why did you say that? Why did that person say that? What? And I'll think about it for like an hour. What? I don't know what possesses me to care that much about such short comments, but it's amazing how much I've noticed that I get so stuck on the most basic things. And it's unbelievable. And then the last part, have good conversations. I really like people a lot, and I like connecting with them, and that's part of my job, so that's pretty great. But it's also just part of my everyday life, and I think sometimes I get really stuck with that too, of, okay, what should I say? Okay, they're judging me right now. Oh gosh, I need to say something really smart now. And then I get anxious about something, whatever, you know, it's just amazing. But then I just try to come back, okay, just ask some questions. How are you doing? What's the best part of your day? You know, like, have a basic conversation with someone. Wow, shocking, that's not that big of a deal. But it brings me back to the connection that I want with other people. And then it goes with everything, you know, with my sister-in-law. I have immense difficulty with her, and I just, okay, there's only so much I can do, but I'm gonna just have a conversation with her. I want to see, well, what is she most excited about right now? What's going on with her? Even that is difficult, but just, you know, starting small, you know, with, like I mentioned earlier, with how do I engage with what is going on in the world today, what is going on in our country today, and how can I interact with people, how can I engage with my white privilege? And sometimes I think the most basic way to do that is to have conversations with people, to one-on-one conversations with other people about what's going on. And that's just one place to start. Or with my coworkers. Sometimes we don't get along, sometimes we don't see eye to eye, but I just engage them in conversation and try to start from there. So I just wanted to say thank you again for sitting through this talk and for just your presence this evening. I hope you guys have some comments, hope something resonated with you this evening. So go for it.
Thank you, Katie, for a very sweet and practical talk. You mentioned your work. Could you just say briefly for people what the work you do? Because I think it's really
I work for a small nonprofit, and we support immigrants on their path to citizenship, and mostly just provide legal services for different immigrants in different stages of their lives.
Thank you.
Deal with the fun bureaucracy of immigration.
So, thank you very much. Comments, questions, responses for Katie, please.
Katie, I couldn't get the third advice. The third one is a conversation.
Have good conversations.
Oh, have a good one.
Yeah.
I thought you... I couldn't hear it, so I thought you were at the end of conversation.
Oh, no, thanks for clarifying.
I have a good conversation.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So, responses or questions for Katie? David.
First, thank you for opening your heart to us. Thank you so much. I'm reminded of some Native American practices that I've done, and they would look at winter as the death that comes before life, mm-hmm. instead of the death that comes after life. We think in terms, this is part of the cycle, this is part of the renewal that goes on, and I was very touched to hear you say that. And winter in the Midwest does have its quiet time, its own special beauty. And what I'm touched by for myself personally is that I'm always busy running the car, going here and there, and it's maybe a good thing to maybe just take a walk with no schedule, you know, implied there, just to do that, and just to hear the quiet that can be in winter. And it's, in a sense, like sitting, because if you go somewhere, you know, maybe not too far from the city, somewhere quiet, and just listening to the silence that winter brings more than any other season. And I appreciate your saying it. Thank you very much.
Laurel.
Hi, Katie. Oh, thanks so much for coming out and opening up. I really appreciate it. Being brought up in a Christian family like most of us in this culture that we're in, I think about the symbol for Christianity. And I think it was Constantine who came up with the idea of having the cross as a symbol. Made his swords and such. But I'm thinking, if Christ was around in the 19th or 20th century, would it be him hanging by a noose? Would that be the symbol? Or would he be strapped to an electric chair?
Mm-hmm.
And I always thought that was just such a gruesome thing to have as a symbol for a religion. It never made sense to me. And I just liked so much about winter and accepting it and really kind of grabbing onto it, embracing it. And I can't say that I embrace it, but I do get out of it. You know, I've got dogs, I like walking in the park, and last winter I couldn't do it. It was just way too cold. But this year I've been getting out more and walking the dogs. And you're right, my wife and I we're very fortunate to have a country home northwest of the city. And the city's beautiful during the winter when it snows, but out in the country it's just amazing, you know. And it's I've spent my whole life in the city, and being in the country when I can get the time is a very, very special time for me and my wife. You touched on so many things, and I think about young people knowing and learning things way before I did, you know, and I'm jealous of it. It's not fair. But then, you know, I have to accept what my life has brought me and how it brought me to this place where I am today. And I'm also reminded when I sit to accept all those things and all the hardships that I had to go through to get to this place, which I was talking to Dave, I said, God, before we sat, some great stuff's been happening, you know, in the last 7 months. That's all I've been sitting for. And I don't know how, why, I can't really explain it, but it's taken up this vacuum that was missing, and it's really cool stuff, and I really appreciate you coming out. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for your talk, Katie, and even more than that, thank you for being such a wonderful member of the Sangha. Because this place couldn't work without people like you that are willing to put yourself out and do things like talks and ring bells and chant and greet. And it just makes such a difference that to have people that give of themselves that way. And I'm sure you get back from it, because we all do get back from it. But if there's others in the room that are interested in being part of the Sangha this way, Katie's a really good example of someone just quietly doing so many important things for us and with us. So thank you very much. And just one other thing, I love this idea of having three things. I think that's the perfect number. My three things that I like are Gary Snyder's three things at the end of his poem to the children, where he says, stay together, learn the flowers, go light. There's
another
great three things.
So,
thank you.
Anyway,
I think it's a good. I think our mind can offer
exactly. Thanks a lot. Thank you for your talk. I agree. It's refreshing to hear other people's stories and path, you know, into this. And I especially like the discussion, the part of the poem about winter, because I do find that I tend to sometimes pull inward in winter and avoid or not want to get very far from my car. And but when I do, I mean, I relate to this because I grew up on a farm and I was outside every day, you know, as soon as school was out until bedtime in the morning. You know, so I have been in the woods. I have been outdoors a lot in the winter at other points in my life, and it's beautiful. It brings you out, you know. This is encouraging me. I have an appointment to make tomorrow. I think I'll take the bus, so I have to walk.
Thanks, Kat.
Yes, Jessica.
It was a really lovely talk. One thing I wanted to let you know is that as a friend, something I've always admired about you is your ability to ask excellent questions, and the way that you actively listen and engage with people. It's been a huge inspiration to me. I don't know, I think you should know that. And maybe not stress so much about the way you interact with people. They think you're excellent at it.
You mentioned a little bit about, thank you, first of all, thank you very much for talking. You mentioned a little bit about how your Catholic upbringing has influenced your practice today. I was curious about if there were any specific practices that you practiced growing up as a Catholic in a Catholic household that that draws parallel to your practice today or not.
That's a good question. I mean, like I mentioned really briefly, just the rituals of everything, that not the rituals aren't necessarily similar, but just the act of ritual provides a lot of comfort to me. And I mean, I think I see it in a different light perhaps now, but it's kind of nice to have that again, I guess. I don't know what else. I sort of tend to not think about it a ton and avoid it a little bit. So, I don't know. I'd have to think about it. Let me get back to you in a couple weeks. That one's real. Sorry about that.
Maybe, I enjoyed your talk. You had some very good ideas. I was wondering what the lasting effect had that did not answer that event had on you? Was it a big eye-opener to you?
I think... I mean, everything I did that year as a begin, you know, my first year of college was eye-opening to me. I mean, like, every small thing. But I think it was sort of a new perspective that I just hadn't thought about it at all. But I don't really think I thought about it too much at that point. I thought, oh, this is cool. I didn't really think about it too much at that point. And maybe a couple years later, but I was like, oh, sweet. That's interesting thoughts. And okay, you're really bringing together some good ideas. I like what's happening here, but it wasn't necessarily like a life changing thing right away.
So what did first get your attention about, Buddhism or Zen first got your attention? I guess you started sitting. What precipitated that?
Yeah, I don't really remember too much. I think people were just like, hey, you should think about meditation. I think people knew that I was anxious. And they were like, okay, get that work done. You know, they're just trying to like appease me a little bit. And I think so many people told me, I was okay, fine, all right. And then, yeah, I think in college I read some Thich Nhat Hanh and a couple of, I don't really remember that much. And it's not that hard to convince me to try something new. So it just sort of felt right away. There wasn't a lot of issues with it. So I don't know how else to say, like, it just felt good. And it was very easy to explore, and a lot of things I sort of thought about it, but I hadn't really put to words, and it was good for me to ask questions. I think that was good, just the idea of being okay with questions and not having the answers to them.
Mm-hmm. Ben,
and thanks, Katie, for so boldly putting your experience out there, first of all. I come from what I think is a fairly similar place, and the kinds of things you're talking about, especially the embracing the innermost winner, like as much as you possibly can, that's like the most true thing that I've found to be so far in my life. So there, that externalize is really encouraging. And two, the focusing as best as you can in each moment, that's something I'm starting to focus on as well. How do you do that?
Oh, I don't know if I'm the best person to ask about that. I mean, Tiger? All sorts of ways. I mean, I think I would kind of say that I've been thinking a lot about habits and habit forming lately. And for me, what works best is just constantly coming back to the moment, whatever I'm doing. I mean, I think it's hard because I don't know what you do for with your time, but it's just constantly. I have clients all the time, and my coworkers demanding things from me, and I just stop. I just stop what I'm doing, and I close my door, and I take some time. Or if I'm on the train, just stop what I'm doing and think about what's going on. I mean, I think it's depends what works for you, but that's just like a really easy first step. Tigan?
I think that's really a lovely way to say it, just to and I think each of us has our own way of doing that, but just to pause, you know, hit the pause button, take a breath, stop, and just, I like as you said, you close the door and just take a minute. But it's an art how we find our way to be present and look at what we're doing. And it's not about doing it perfectly or correctly, or you know, it's a lifelong process. So I just want to close by thanking Katie for a really beautiful, sweet talk, very practical. And I will see winter freshly. Thank you so much.